Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. The before times seem like a decade ago, don't they? Those carefree days when hugging friends and shaking hands wasn't verboten. When we didn't have to reach for a mask before leaving our homes or forage for supplies of hand sanitizer. Oh, for the days when social distancing wasn't part of our vernacular. That was the opening paragraph from an August 17th article that appeared in the digital journal Stat, produced by Boston Globe Media. It has been 7 months since Governor Tony Evers first issued an emergency order shutting down non-essential businesses in Wisconsin, and the COVID-19 pandemic was just starting to become a reality. What many thought would last a few weeks or perhaps months stretched into a long-term fight against a disease that has so far killed more than 210,000 Americans, including more than 1,400 people in Wisconsin. As the number of infections continues to grow, the science has also evolved, bringing us new understanding of what the novel coronavirus is and the risks posed by and to the community. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, in for Shireen Siewert this week. Coming up in the program, we'll get a public health perspective on statewide efforts to stem the pandemic with Julie Willems-Van Dyke, Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. And later on, Dr. Hoang McLean from the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute joins us to share some promising research she's involved with on a hyper-local level. Joining us now is Dr. Jonathan Tempte from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Tempte, thank you for joining us, and welcome back to Route 51. Email your questions to route51@wpr.org. And due to some technical situations, our phone lines are not operating today. Again, that email address is route51@wpr.org. Dr. Tempte, how has our understanding of the virus evolved since the beginning of the pandemic, and what do we know about the nature of the virus?
Well, I think the nature of the virus is that it is very tenacious. It is out there, and it tends to spread easily from person to person. And I think we've understood that from very, very early on. But I think the thing that really amazes us is how incredibly persistent this has been and how widespread it has become. And because of that, how much it has affected all of our lives.
Well, one of the questions that came to us from a listener before the program aired was the virus itself does seem, in general, to affect differently with the different age groups in our population. But the one thing that is still pretty much a mystery to a lot of folks, especially none of those that that are in the health industry, but it affects youth differently. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. When we take a look, for example, in Wisconsin, we see that the number of cases really have peaked out in individuals age 20 to 29. That's the most common group to come down with this virus and who are detected. On the other hand, if we look at hospitalization, it really is pushed up into those upper years, you know, above the age of 60 in particular. And when we look at things like death, we find that it's pushed up even higher. So particularly age 70 and above have high rates of death. On the flip side, across Wisconsin, and our fingers are crossed, but we have yet to experience any death in an individual between the age of 0 and 29 years. At the same time, we do see some hospitalization in the state of Wisconsin for individuals, you know, particularly 0 to 9 years, 10 to 19, but those tend to be low compared to other groups out there. So when infected, people who are young tend to do much better with this virus. There is some discussion out there that younger people may be a little less susceptible to this virus. I'm not sure if we're fully in agreement with that as of yet, just because if you consider what we've done starting back in mid-March, removing children from schools, which tend to be a great way to accelerate viruses, introduces some, you know, artifact in the whole situation. But the bottom line is kids seem like they're less prone to the significant outcomes of this virus, and they may be a little bit less likely to come down with this.
Are they less likely to spread the disease?
Well, there have now been a number of studies looking at household transmission, and what we find, our children are able to spread this quite well. Early on, some of the reports said children were less likely to spread, but I think, again, we have to keep in mind that once a child is infected, they tend to have fairly high levels of virus in their respiratory secretions, and they tend to cough and sneeze like the rest of us. But again, they have less of those symptoms. But if they do, the likelihood of transmission is there. And so what we have found in a number of studies now is household transmission is actually quite high if there's a case within that household. So the bottom line is trying to avoid this virus, regardless of age, is going to be important.
Okay. Well, right now, coming up with a vaccine, a viable vaccine, is really at the top of mind of Americans. And Americans seem to really expect it quickly. This week, the New York Times vaccine tracker reports 45 vaccines in clinical trials on humans and 91 preclinical trials under active investigation on animals. But on the other hand, this week, Johnson & Johnson paused its phase 3 trial to investigate a potential adverse reaction in a trial, and other pharmaceutical companies have also paused. Dr. Tempty, you're an expert on vaccines and vaccine policy. Is this science at work?
This is indeed science at work, and this is what should be happening. And whenever there is a clinical trial for a vaccine, and we encounter an unexpected finding, the first thing that happens is a small group of individuals who have privilege to see whether or not that individual received the vaccine or placebo are able to look at that. And further, then they start looking at really intense and intricate assessments of the immunology. Is what they're seeing a possible reaction to the vaccine? Or is this something that is not likely to be biologically possible? So we utilize people with great knowledge within immunology and other medical science to determine that. But this is why it's so very, very important to allow the clinical trials to proceed as they're designed to proceed. They're set up to accumulate cases of individuals, whether or not you're immunized or placebo. And that takes time to accumulate those cases. Likewise, we have to have a fair setting to accumulate any side effects that could occur, and then to be able to use the science to help us determine whether or not those side effects are due to the vaccine, due to a random occurrence, or something else like that. And so it's really, really important to not rush that science and let it proceed. But this absolutely is science at work here.
Well, walk us through a typical timeline. What does that look like for coming up with a vaccine?
Well, in the usual situation, from concept to licensure and in the arms of my patients, is oftentimes anywhere from 10 to 15 years. With the coronavirus, because this is a pandemic of international concern, there has been a great amount of acceleration. A number of labs across the world have been working on this very early on, and there was very, very early sharing of the genetic blueprints of the protein or the antigen in this virus that most groups are going after for vaccine manufacture. That being said, with the investment of huge amounts of money, a lot of companies put every effort into this. And you've heard of the Operation Warp Speed. Mm-hmm. And this has been a private-public partnership to share some of the cost. And what we're finding right now is a lot of the manufacturers are jumping ahead of the usual and manufacturing a lot of doses with the hope that their vaccine is approved for use. And so oftentimes what we wait for is, the clinical trials get done, we go through the process for licensure, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices reviews and makes a recommendation, and then the company goes, okay, now we need to start making vaccine. In the current situation, a lot of the work is being done up front, waiting for those clinical trials to finish and show that vaccines are not only effective, but are very safe. And once that threshold is crossed, we hope to have a lot of vaccine already available that we can start using to confront this pandemic.
Well, at the beginning, through right to today, we hear the concept of herd immunity. Now, do you see a point in the near future where you have folks that have been infected with the virus and combine that with enough people that have been vaccinated for the virus and developing antibodies to combat this virus? Do you see a point in time where the effects of the COVID-19 virus will be dissipated over time? Is there such a thing really as herd immunity?
There absolutely is herd immunity. The best example I can give that we're all aware of is the measles vaccine. Incredibly safe and effective vaccine. And we don't deal with measles for the most part in this country, not because everyone gets the vaccine, but 93% of us do. And that protects the other 7%. That's herd immunity. Other viruses require less, but the challenge with SARS-CoV-2 and our COVID-19 disease is we have to get enough individuals vaccinated so we get up to a population level probably in the range of 55 to 70% of people immune. And as you mentioned, part of that can come from natural immunity. You're infected and you recover, and hopefully you're immune for some time. And part of that, we hope, comes from the vaccine. But we have to keep in mind that to get that vaccine-induced immunity, it's a calculation between the percent of people who are receiving the vaccine and how effective that vaccine is. So if the vaccine protects, for example, 60% of people who receive the vaccine and 50% of the population get the vaccine, you multiply those together, and that gives us about 30% protection to add on to that pre-existing immunity. So we really have to work hard to get that number of people receiving the vaccine as high as possible. And we hope that the vaccine is as effective as possible. So we sometimes deal with vaccines that are only 40 or 50% effective. And there are some, for example, the German measles or rubella vaccine, which is 98% effective. And so we hope for a high effective vaccine, and we hope for a lot of people to receive it. And that will help us get out of this.
And briefly, you also are an expert in seasonal influenza epidemiology. Why, at this time of year, why is the flu shot even more important?
Well, the flu shot is important every year. And we do know that it prevents illness and hospitalization and death. But this year, it is really, really confusing for clinicians and others out there in decision making. So if I can reduce the likelihood that a patient comes to my clinic with a cough and fever, that's a good thing. Because when that patient comes to the clinic, we have to assume right now that's the COVID-19. And even because of that, you have seen clinical practices across Wisconsin, across the country change. And if you're a patient coming to my clinic and call up over the phone saying that you have a fever and a cough, you're going to get directed elsewhere. But anything we can do to lessen the likelihood that people have these symptoms that can be avoided because of a vaccine, the better. This helps all of us, you know, get through this winter. It helps protect us from, you know, a known pathogen that is significant, not as significant as SARS-CoV-2, but influenza is significant. If we can reduce that, we're going to be better off all around.
Dr. Jonathan Tempte from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health has been our guest for this segment of Route 51. Dr. Tempte, thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you so much, Rick, for having me. You take care now.
You too. When we return, we'll get an update on the status of COVID-19 in our state and efforts to stem its spread with Julie Willems-Van Dyke, Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. You can join the conversation by email at route51@wpr.org. I'm Rick Ryer, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer in for Shereen Seward. Now we focus our conversation on the current status of COVID-19 in our state and efforts to contain it. Joining us now is Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Julie Willems-Van Dyke. Julie, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Rick.
We'd like to hear from you as well. You can email your questions to route51@wpr.org. Julie, yesterday the Wisconsin Department of Health Services reported a record-setting 3,747 new cases and more than 1,000 hospitalizations and 17 new deaths from COVID-19. At the same time, the DHS reported 84% of all available hospital beds were occupied by people suffering from the virus. Why such a spike and why now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one thing I just want to clarify, Rick, is it's 85% of the hospital beds are filled. They're not filled with people with COVID-19. But it's a really important point because we clearly, as you say, are seeing more people in our hospitals with this dreadful disease. And we need to be sure and keep our hospitals available for all of the other things people need hospitals for, like if you're having a heart attack or a stroke or you need treatment for cancer or the whole variety of things. So it's a complicated situation, and we definitely need to be working together to protect those hospital beds. Why now? What's the spike about? Well, I think, you know, if we think about it, we've been at this for a good 7 months. COVID really came into public life last March, and it's been a long haul. And I think people have what I would call COVID fatigue. In the first months, everybody understood this is a highly infectious virus, and we have to control it by staying apart from each other, because that's how it spread, and people did that really vigorously in March and April and into May last year. And then, you know, we're social human beings, and so we want to be with our family and friends, and so people started intermingling. And the good news was in the summer, we could do a lot of that outside, and the COVID virus is less likely to transmit when we're outside in more open air, and especially if we can stay apart from each other at least 6 feet. And we started to see cases rise, but not at the rate we're seeing now. Now people are inside for the most part, and that means they're closer together, and that's when we see this disease transmitting even more more aggressively. So I think it's really important that you're going to hear me say this over and over again. We need to wear masks. That protects us. We need to stay at least 6 feet away from each other. We need to minimize how many people we see outside of our own household. Every time you interact with someone outside of your household, you are increasing your risk. We need to wash our hands frequently and really just hold to the kind of behavior we did back in March and April for a little bit longer until we can get through this surge and actually get us on the other side of this thing to where we have a vaccine.
You know, we have this large number that came up yesterday. What do we know about the number of people who haven't been tested but may have this virus?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things we've learned about COVID-19 and is what contributes to this widespread dissemination of the disease is that it can be present in people who don't have any symptoms. And so they may not be ill themselves, but that doesn't mean they're not transmitting the disease to others. The other thing is it also is infectious. People are infectious for a day or two before they have symptoms. So these kind of diseases are ones that spread very quickly. Think chickenpox or measles. You know, they spread very, very quickly. And so we have a lot of people who may be spreading this disease and don't know it and don't even know to go get tested because they don't have any symptoms themselves. So clearly testing is part of our strategy. We want to increase testing so that people know if they have the infection. And then what's really important is you have to isolate until for at least 10 days and until your symptoms are gone. And you need to let your contacts know they've been exposed so they can stay home and quarantine in case they're brewing the infection themselves so they don't spread it to others. It's really that combination of testing, contact tracing, or taking those actions around isolation and quarantine that will help us stop the spread here.
Right now, what is the status of testing here in Wisconsin and the status of contact tracing?
Yeah, we have been working very, very hard as a public health system. I want to give a big shout out to our local health departments across the state who have, you know, for the last 7-8 months have been working night and day on this issue and big shout out to them. We have expanded testing through our state vigorously, and testing is available through health systems. Healthcare systems are the largest source of testing in our state. And in addition to that, we've done work to increase the presence of community testing, working with our great partners at the Wisconsin National Guard. We're in the process of expanding our testing. One of the things we've learned through this process is with the use of technology and with continuous improvement, we have guard teams that are able to collect many more test specimens in a much shorter period of time. And so we're splitting up our guard team so they can be in more places. And we'll be locating a number of testing sites throughout north central Wisconsin over the next week or two. So for people to find a testing site near you, we encourage them to go to our website. Just log on to dhs.wisconsin.gov/testing. And you'll be able to find a map that will indicate to you where all the community testing sites are across the state and within your own community.
Thank you.
Contact tracing.
Yes.
You asked about contact tracing, too. So back in May, we estimated how many cases we thought we might see a week, and we were able to use funding from the federal government, the CARES Act funding, to provide additional dollars to local health departments so they could hire more contact tracers. And likewise, we did so at the state, knowing there would be surges in communities that would overwhelm local health departments. What I can tell you is, you know, right now we're seeing 3 to 4 times the number of cases we estimated back then. And so, not surprisingly, that means our contact tracers have been overwhelmed. We just hired another 95 people who started at the state to provide additional surge capacity. We're hiring additional staff. I know local health departments are working very hard to meet this need. And so I think it's a dual effort. One is we'll build further contact tracing, but the other is how do we let the public know what they need to do if a contact tracer doesn't get to them right away? And that goes back to if you are positive, you need to stay home for 10 days or until you are free of symptoms for 72 hours, whichever is longer. And if you've been exposed to someone with COVID-19, you need to quarantine for 14 days. That means don't leave your house, except we encourage you to go get a test to see if you're one of those folks who may have the disease but not have any symptoms. So,
with this, the overwhelming work on contact tracers and folks that are testing on the front lines, are there support services for those individuals on the front line?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think many organizations have employee assistance programs, and that we encourage employees to use. We've been thinking further about how we support staff and providing opportunities for people to connect and talk about the challenge of this. You know, our hospital workers are also experiencing this surge of incredible work. I read an article recently where a gentleman was talking about his experience being hospitalized with COVID-19, encouraging people to wear masks so they didn't end up in the boat he was in, and talking about his nurses working 17 days in a row. And I can assure you that people who are doing testing, people who are doing contact tracing are working hours like that. So I think the other thing that our listeners can do to support those people is show them you care by wearing your mask and by staying home. It's what we all do together to link arms as neighborly Wisconsinites to address this so that we can reverse the trend on this disease, and so we won't need as many healthcare workers in the hospital or contact tracers to call people as we start to stem the spread of the disease.
Julie, this week, a Sawyer County judge temporarily blocked the Governor Evers administration order limiting public gatherings and capacity in bars and restaurants. The judge took this action because of a suit brought up by the Wisconsin Tavern League, the Sawyer County Tavern League, and Flambeau Forest Inn, and will be heard on Monday, the case itself, with DHS attorneys defending the order. How do you see this case affecting your department's efforts in getting the virus under control?
Well, you know, the defense of this I'll leave to the lawyers, but let me talk about why we put that order in place. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're finding through contact tracing is that people are spreading this virus in gatherings. And the order talks about public places and limiting gatherings based on capacity of a given building. But equally, we need to think about private places as well. What we're seeing is oftentimes the disease is spread, particularly in family gatherings. We like to think our family members are safe, but this virus is a wicked enemy, and it doesn't understand the love of families protecting from spread of the virus. And so the order is put in place to help remind people that any time you are gathering with people who are outside your household, and the more numbers, the more likelihood of spread, the more risk there is. And that risk is not only to you, but to the other person and to the other people those people are in contact with. So, you know, Wisconsin, we don't necessarily have to have an order in order for us to do the right thing. Now, I also want to say, Rick, we understand how challenging this whole virus and the changes in behavior have been for small businesses like restaurants and bars. And so the governor has also allocated additional funds for the We're All In program through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And I encourage businesses who are experiencing financial hardship to go to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation website and look at that grant. It's in a new application period because we are also using many of those federal dollars to address that economic impact that is happening for our wonderful small businesses in this state.
Thank you for that. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention gave state immunization managers only 30 days to draft a comprehensive COVID-19 vaccine distribution plan. Today is the deadline for those plans that are due. Is your department, you know, first of all, was that a realistic deadline? And how has your department prepared to make that? And is there briefly a glimpse of the plan that you can share with us?
Sure. Well, here's what I'd say about realistic. Nothing with COVID-19 has been realistic.
True.
And we've all had to respond and adapt and as we've learned more. You know, we've all been learning together about this virus. And I know sometimes it's confusing for people because they hear one thing one week and then a few weeks later we're saying something else. And that's because we've learned more. In terms of the vaccination plan, we are putting the finishing touches on our plan and we'll be submitting it today. It is a living, breathing document, and so just like everything COVID-related, it is a beginning point, and we will continue to refine it as we move forward. And we'll be continuing to do that both in partnership with our federal partners at the Centers for Disease Control and with local stakeholders throughout the state. A little preview of some of the things we're talking about in the plan. First of all, CDC and the American Committee on Immunization Practice will be helping with prioritizing which populations will be available to get the vaccine when the first doses come out. We fully anticipate when the first doses come out, they'll largely be focused on healthcare workers. You know, you think about people working in emergency rooms and in ICUs and on medical surgical floors throughout our hospitals and our clinics. Those are people who are being exposed to people who are infectious and need our care. From there, priority groups who are at highest risk for the disease or have borne the greatest burden of the disease will likely be prioritized next, and then as more vaccine becomes available, the broader general public. The plan works on how we'll distribute and administer the vaccine, and that will be through a combination of methods. Certainly, just like with testing, our healthcare system is the backbone of providing healthcare and immunizations. And again, just like testing, when the volume of what you need to do goes up dramatically, we'll also be looking to mass vaccination clinics available throughout communities throughout the state. The last thing I'd say, just so your listeners have a little bit more information, it is a two-dose vaccine series that are being tested in these final clinical trials. So people will need to plan for getting two doses. And what we understand is it's very important that you time those doses exactly as directed. So you receive one dose, and then depending on which of the manufacturers vaccine you are receiving, either 21 days later or 28 days later, you'll receive the second dose. And the last thing I'd say is, you know, we're working very closely on understanding the results of the clinical trials and the processes we'll be doing to assure that this is a safe vaccine that we'll be distributing to the public and has had all of the appropriate approvals necessary in order to deliver a safe and effective vaccine to our fellow residents of Wisconsin.
Deputy Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, Julie Willems-Van Dyke, has been our guest for this segment of Route 51. Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Rick. Have a great day.
You as well. When we return, we'll get a hyper-local look at some cutting-edge research on the virus that's happening right in our backyard with Dr. Hoang McLean of the Marshall Clinic Research Institute. This is Route 51 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer in for Shireen Seward. We're joined now by Dr. Hoang McLean of the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. Dr. McLean, thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
We invite your questions as well at WPR at Route51@WPR.org. Dr. McLean, recently or just yesterday was released information that the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute Center for Clinical Epidemiology and Population Health received a $4 million grant from the Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention to administer a study concentrating on rural Wisconsin. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So this study is a cohort study where we will be following up to 1,500 participants for up to a year to learn more about how COVID-19 or the coronavirus disease affects the rural population.
And what are you specifically going to be looking into?
Well, we want to know how many people will get sick in the rural areas, how they get infected, and what types of illness they have, including asymptomatic infections. As we're learning, there's a broad range of illness. We don't get the full picture if testing is based on just respiratory symptoms or having a known contact with someone.
And your current research that you've worked with the CDC and Vanderbilt University, among others, how does COVID-19 compare to other viruses that have emerged in the recent past, like SARS and MERS?
So the COVID-19 virus is also a SARS virus. SARS and MERS is one of seven coronaviruses that infect humans. Let's take a step back. There are four common viruses that cause what we typically call a cold. They are mild illness, but they're highly contagious and infections. And then the two newer ones that you just mentioned, SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, and MERS, Middle East respiratory symptoms, are recently jumped from animal hosts to humans, and they cause more severe illness, but they don't spread as easily. The new coronavirus, the SARS coronavirus 2 that causes the COVID or coronavirus disease we're seeing now actually has can spread easily and can cause severe illness.
Now, you had mentioned or you have said before to our producer that there is a difference in comparing the RNA of SARS-CoV-2 and other coronaviruses, that this one that we're dealing with now appears to mutate more slowly. Why is that, and what is the significance of that?
So coronaviruses in general is a RNA viruses. They typically don't have, most RNA viruses typically don't have the proofreading mechanisms, but coronaviruses do have the ability to correct mistakes, which makes the virus more stable. Now, that doesn't mean that it does not mutate. I mean, it had to mutate be able to transmit in humans. They just mutate or acquire changes slower than other RNA viruses. For example, for influenza viruses, we see that's constantly changing. That's one of the reasons why we need a flu vaccine every year. But the longer the coronavirus is passed through people or transmit in our community, the more likely the virus will acquire mutations or there'll be small changes that can make the virus less recognizable to our immune system and maybe more difficult to fight. We already see some evidence of small mutations that may make the virus or allow the virus to grow or replicate more quickly. And then there's some other indicators that there might be some other ones, but we just don't know what that may look like.
Well, where does that play into developing a vaccine? If right now the mutation is slow, but it could advance as we go further, what are you seeing or what do you see as the potential for that in developing that vaccine?
So it really depends on where the mutation happens. There's, you know, depending on how the vaccines are developed, they target certain parts of the virus. And so the mutation happens in a key area that may impact how we fight, make it more difficult for us to fight the virus if there is mutations.
Now you're involved in another study right now with respect to focusing on internal transmission within households and how to prevent it. Tell us about that study.
Yeah, so this study is looks at household transmission, not just in the community, but looking specifically at households. We know that households, there's a lot of transmission in households because of the close contact and the potential for this virus to transmit before someone feels ill. This study enrolls participants in the Marshfield, Wausau, Weston, and Eau Claire area who have COVID-19 disease or COVID and their household contacts. And the contacts, the participants will swab every day for 14 days so we can look to see who gets infected. We also look at blood samples a month later to look for antibodies.
When designing these studies, do you track or account for participant behavior or other risk factors such as essential worker status or underlying conditions?
We try to look at some of that information as well. We look at how, you know, age factors, does that matter? Are kids more likely to spread than other households or adults? How often does it spread in households? We look at behaviors that may reduce the spread of particularly in households.
Mm-hmm. And Marshfield Clinic's research arm, where you are at, will also be doing a vaccine safety evaluation when the vaccine becomes available in our community. And you're hoping to sequence the virus's DNA. What can you tell us about that?
So when we sequence the virus, we can learn more about how it's changing and the patterns of spread. So in some of the first study you mentioned, we can look at whether or not it changes throughout the community with the spread. It can help us guide us to where we can help with, like you said, the vaccines. Learn where which parts are can be targeted for treatment as well when you sequence.
And based on your research, Dr. McLean, what does the Central Wisconsin community need to know about COVID-19 and its spread?
That it's highly transmissible. You can spread before someone has illness, in particular in households. So as soon as someone feels ill, you should isolate. And, of course, wear your mask, wash your distance, and wash your hands.
And can you tell me a little bit more, you know, as you're doing your research on this particular strain, this COVID-19 coronavirus, what has been the most fascinating thing that you found out or that you're working on?
Ah, that's a tough question. Yeah. We're learning stuff every day on this virus, and it's hard to keep up. Everything is fascinating. Like this morning, I just learned more about some of the potential mutations that we might be seeing and how that might affect transmission in the future.
Earlier,
the more data we get, the more we're learning about this virus and how quickly the scientific community is gathering that data is just amazing to me. The vaccine development.
Well, I wanted to mention or at least talk to you about what we discussed earlier in the program with Dr. Jonathan Tempte from the University of Wisconsin. And we're talking about how the differences between COVID-19 and influenza and the importance now of people getting that flu shot. It's important regardless of what he had said, but even more so at this time around. What can you tell us about that? And why?
So I agree I agree with Dr. Temke. This illness we see with coronavirus is similar to flu, but we can't distinguish it just by the symptoms. And if you can protect yourself from flu and avoid potentially, if both viruses are circulating at the same time, co-infection with that, both viruses, which we really don't know very much about yet.
And I wanted to ask you, but going back to the study that you'll be embarking on with the rural study, what specifically are you going to be looking at in the rural communities with the grant from the CDC?
There's a lot. We're going to be collecting a lot of data. The most important question we want to know is how often infection occurs in the community and by what age group. There's a lot of studies that just look at certain high-risk groups and households that we're enrolling participants from all age spectrums. So we'll get a good idea of how often it occurs for each of the age groups. And within each age group, how often or what percentage of the people do not have symptoms or typical symptoms of COVID-19.
Dr. Hoang McLean from the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute has been our guest for this segment of Route 51 Today. Dr. McLean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer, and I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Hoang McLean, Julie Willems-Van Dyke, and Dr. Jonathan Tempte. Joy Ratch-Kramer and Shireen Seward produced the program today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme, and you can hear an archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, we'll revisit education in the midst of COVID-19. Until then, we're heading out of town.